SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Thursday, race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964, Sirius XM Online, and at our website as well. And a day Thursday that had its share of explosive headlines. And the early ones came from the sale ring. And shortly thereafter, from another New York Times treatment of a circumstance around the game. And we'll get to the $8.2 million beholder sister that Mandy Pope bought. Brian DiDonato will join us from the TDN in a little bit. We'll start with this story from Joe Drape that sensationalizes a scopolamine positive from after the Santa Anita Derby for Justify. And very quickly after Drape's story, which, like so many other treatments, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation story, the PETA Asmussen investigation story, the I'll Have Another Vet Records story, shoots first, then asks questions later. And the rush to judgment last night, of course, was furious and immediately. You know, summary judgments made about everything involving the story. And, I mean, in a nutshell, the suggestion is that, well, the CHRB, they had this positive and they swept it under the rug. Well, that's really not what seems to have transpired, especially in light of further reporting and more detailed reporting involving Matt Hegarty in the Daily Racing Form and Bill Finley in the TDN, who both had opportunities to talk to Dr. Rick Arthur, the equine medical director in California. And, you know, as always with these stories, there is absolute legitimate issues to be addressed within the context of the reporting. But the way in which these have been presented consistently with an attempt to humiliate and embarrass the sport is astounding. And then the dust settles and all the ancillary details come out and there's a whole different perspective. Well, a lot of those details came out very quickly last night with Hegarty and Bill Finley's additional reporting, and specifically Rick Arthur's addressing of elements of what Joe Drape alleged. Alan Foreman joins us, and Alan is our resource when it comes to topics like this. And scopolamine, which is naturally occurring along with atropine in jimson weed, this is an old contamination storyline in hay that goes back decades in California, particularly. And Richard Mandela dealt with it, and Ron McAnally and others. And this is one that they are very familiar with in California. And Alan, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, thanks for coming on, because, you know, the immediate you know, the immediate aftermath of these kinds of stories is always, you know, the industry painted as darkly as possible. And we already see today that the news channels have got a crawl, you know, Justify tested positive before Derby. They might include that Justify was tested before the Derby Preakness and out of competition before the Belmont too, and then post race and then no issues. But you know, this certainly feels from a timing standpoint like it is, like so many of these other times approaches to the industry seems designed to support an agenda.
Well, I certainly think that way. And look, I'm an industry insider, so people can dismiss what I have to say because I'm one of the insiders who supposedly is always there defending the industry against these kinds of attacks. But make no mistake about it, this was an intended gut punch. It certainly will harm the reputation of Bob Baffert. It will hurt the reputation of the industry. I think it's part of a scorched earth policy that's been in place for some time by those who are pushing for federal legislation to strip the states of their authority and ability to regulate the sport and to get the control of the industry into the hands of handpicked individuals who are handpicked by certain organizations in our industry, and to otherwise, just take over the regulation of the sport. And there can be no other explanation for this because when you really look at this, the public certainly reacts to it because the public doesn't know any differently. When you see INE on the end of a drug, you think it's something that's really bad, nefarious, that this is another example of a serious drugging offense, and they draw the conclusions that were intended by the article.
Yeah. Before we talk some of the wider implications and aftermath potentially, let's talk the specific, because scopolamine and atropine too, which very frequently occurs and tests when there is, you know, gypsum involved. And, you know, gypsum is out in the fields. Interestingly, horses generally, when they're foraging out and just themselves out picking things up to chew on in the field, they generally will avoid it. When it's dried, though, and part of flake that, you know, that they're fed daily with their hay, they will ingest it. And it, you know, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, it's been dealt with by regulators for years.
Yeah, the implication in the article was that Bob Baffert or someone in his employ intentionally gave scopolamine to Justify in order to affect its performance. And that's, quite frankly, laughable. Scopolamine is not a drug that vets carry in their vet trucks. It's not something you would have in your barn. It's not something that would typically be administered to a horse. Its use, to the extent that it is used, is for horses, the colic, and it's an gastrointestinal spasmatic. Not going to make the horse run any faster. It's a depressant, not a stimulant. But what we do have is quite a body of evidence that it is a known contaminant, and we've been dealing with it for 30 years. And occasionally it crops up, and it crops up in contaminated hay. And you pointed out the perfect example. Back in 1994, in California, there were a rash of scopolamine positives among some of the most storied and reputable trainers in our industry, who were aghast at the fact that there was the possibility that they had a positive test. And the only explanation that could be given for their scopolamine positives was contaminated hay, contaminated feed. They appealed that case. It was handled, almost no differently than this case was handled. They went to a hearing before an administrative law judge who found that they were not responsible, but who disqualified the horses from their winnings. An appeal was then taken to the Superior Court in California, and the court reversed the administrative law judge and found that the commission had the authority not to disqualify the horses and had chosen not to disqualify the horses under their rules. So therefore, the trainers weren't penalized, and there was no disqualification, which, quite frankly, is somewhat precedent for the situation that occurred here. And what that case did do, though, was to generate substantial conversation in the industry and debate about the issue of what we call zero tolerance. And that has been something the industry has debated for years, not 2 or 3 years ago. Some very prominent individuals in racing in Kentucky were accused of a medication violation for a substance falling into the very same category as this one. And they argued that the industry zero tolerance policies were unfair and make no sense in today's world. So this is, again, this is something that's been going on for some time. But with respect to this particular substance, it is a class 4 penalty C drug. It is in a scale of 1 to 5, and we really don't deal with the fives anymore. It's at the lowest rung of the ability to affect the or potential to affect the performance of a horse. And the penalty can range from a fine to a warning, no loss of purse, or, depending on the jurisdiction, a loss of purse.
Let's delve into that part of it and the mechanics, because clearly, you know, these are specifically these kinds of contamination cases, and both Rick Baedeker and Dr. Arthur, in their responses to Matt Hegarty and Bill Finley, you know, both explained that there was no way that this was going to be adjudicated between the time the positive was called by what Cal Davis is the lab, right?
Right.
By the time it was called, and then, you know, would subsequently be, you know, appealed and all the things that go into it. There are elements of this, Alan, that the public and stakeholders in the game feel queasy about, including some of the points that Drape brings up that are, and this is always the case with these stories by Drape, that there's, you know, there's real kernels of important topic it's overwrapped with sensationalized elements that, you know, that are designed to, you know, to provoke horror. But, you know, within the context of some of this that's covered, you know, some of the cross purposes of staffing of state agencies speak to this, and how the industry can balance people on things like the CHRB, like being on that board and having an understanding of the game without being involved so directly that there's conflicts of interest.
Well, look, in this particular situation, whether you have individuals who are your regulators who are familiar with the sport, or you have individuals who are not familiar with the sport, in cases like this, you want to look to your scientific experts for advice. And in this particular situation, as I now read the articles, there was an investigation conducted, and the equine medical director in California, and quite frankly, we all want to have equine medical directors in our states. It's something we've been pushing for. Based on the investigation and based on the science, made a recommendation to the commission that the case should be dropped. That is a responsible thing to do. There was nothing nefarious about that, unless the New York Times or someone else wants to expose that something was nefarious. But then you get the innuendo in the story, well, this one had horses with Baffert, and that one, you know, gets purses because he's an owner, and this one's partners with the owner of the racetrack, and this one's a former jockey. It's all part of that narrative in the federal bill that we've got to get industry-familiar people out of these racing commissions, and we've got to bring totally independent people in to regulate our sport, and that's a double-edged sword. But it's important, I think, what the public doesn't understand is how these cases proceed. It's no different in the sporting world. It's no different in the Olympic Games. It's no different in the international equestrian community. And that is that samples are collected, and there is an anonymous card. It's just got a barcode number that goes with the sample to the laboratory. So nobody knows who those samples belong to. They get tested. If there is a report of a positive test, that report goes to the executive director of the commission, and they then investigate to find out who that belongs to. Okay, and the commission then begins an investigation. It should happen in every case, and it should be confidential. What's, I guess, surprising in this case is normally they would put a hold on the purse pending the investigation, which kind of signals to the industry, it certainly is an indication to the people involved in the race, that the commission is looking at something. And I don't know what they do in California. Maybe they pay out the purses and not do that. But confidentiality is absolutely required and maintained in these situations, because you want to investigate, you want to get it right, and you don't want to harm the reputation of those involved. The trainer has the right. He is notified. They'll go to his barn. They'll shake his barn down. They'll look for the substance. They'll look for other prohibited substances. They'll interview people. And their goal is to try to find out how this substance got into the horse. The second thing is that the trainer can ask to have the B sample tested to ensure that the testing of the A sample was not done erroneously. And most trainers will opt for a B sample to go to another laboratory to be tested. That takes time. That sample comes back either confirmed or not confirmed. In this case, it was confirmed. And you continue that investigation, and then you then meet with the regulators to determine how it got into the horse, what the cause or causes might have been. And the commission continues its investigation, including when you're dealing with scopolamine, the possibility of contamination. So, you know, I only know what I read, but it appears that this moved along a normal track, wasn't treated any differently. Bapper certainly didn't acknowledge that he did anything wrong or could explain how the drug got into the horse. And so, therefore, the question was for the commission, as they dealt with scopolamine for years, what do we do here? Is this contamination? Is it not contamination? They drew the conclusion that it was most likely caused by contamination, and under their rules, they had the ability to determine whether or not to disqualify the horse or not. And their experts advised that this was not a performance-enhancing situation, that the concentration of this contaminant did not affect the performance of the horse, and therefore a disqualification was not warranted. Now, there are other jurisdictions that would require a mandatory disqualification, even if Bob Baffert wasn't penalized. But that was not the rule in California. It's not the rule in many states. And that's how we get to where we are. I don't see anything nefarious going on here. There didn't appear to be any pressure being applied. And it's just a lot of innuendo and tied to other things that clearly will harm Bob Baffert's reputation, harm the public's view of our industry. And it really is doesn't tell the whole story. I'm sorry. It just doesn't.
Well, and that, you know, that's the damaging part of it, is that there's enough open-ended, you know, elements that, you know, every possible negative conclusion gets drawn.
Let me give you an example here. There was reference made to a former equine laboratory director who is, I guess, quoted in the New York Times article saying this had to have been an intentional administration. No scientist will make that conclusion without knowing when the drug was given, how the horse came in contact with the drug, which is the route of administration, and the concentration of the drug that the horse got, because the concentration could mean any number of things, such as the horse may have ingested it some time ago, the horse may have ingested it the day of the race. We don't know how much concentration was in the, assuming it's contaminated, you know, hay or feed, whatever it is. You don't know the concentration, and you don't know the time, so it's unfair to draw that conclusion. And I come back to the same thing. If you're going to give a performance-enhancing drug to a horse to affect its performance in a race, you wouldn't give scopolamine. It's laughable. So, you know, when you do these investigations, one of the things that you have to look at is the nature of the drug, its ability to affect performance, all of the surrounding circumstances, how the barn, you know, this is a top echelon horse. These trainers with top echelon horses are not drugging these horses for purposes of affecting their performance in graded stakes races. Come on.
Well, especially given when it comes to specific regions, including New York, and when it comes to specific race days like Breeders' Cup and Triple Crown days, you know, the out-of-competition testing pre-race, is occurring, and certainly occurred all through this, you know, through the Triple Crown last year, and then post race with urine and blood, and frankly, I mean that element is conveniently, you know, not part of any of this coverage. You know, just the suggestion that somehow, if you know, the part of this that is, you know, hard to explain and roll back is the mechanics, as Rick Arthur actually is quoted, the mechanics and Drape showing, you know, no understanding of the you know, the mechanics, the process of how, you know, how the state agency, how the regulatory body even works, you know, because people are saying, oh, he shouldn't have been able to run in the Derby. Well, that's not the way. That's not the way the process would have worked, you know, even in a serious drug positive circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to look back, but I don't know what the alternative would have been. Sure, I guess they could have expedited an investigation and come to the conclusion that it was contamination, come to the same conclusion, and then there would have been the same or similar brouhaha that, you know, this, a drugged horse was allowed to run in the Derby and, you know, on and on and on. You know, and maybe, you know, maybe the industry is wrong to do this, but I think that they are concerned about reputations. They're concerned about getting it right. And I know the trainers value their reputations. And when you're accused, like this article does, of Bob Baffert of drugging horses, and then they bring in the innuendo of he was suspected of, you know, drugging horses that suffered fatalities years ago, and they try to draw this picture of a very sketchy guy who, quite frankly, is an icon in our sport and deserves better. Confidentiality is important. It's critical in these situations to preserve reputations and to get it right. And so that's what goes on here. It is kept behind closed doors until there's a disposition. And if there is no disposition, then that trainer deserves to ensure that his record is clear and that he's not accused of a doping violation. It's that simple. This was a report from a laboratory of a positive test. This was not a determination of a positive test, final disposition with an adjudication. They are considered reports by the laboratory that are investigated.
Well, and, you know, certainly between April, you know, whatever it was, April 28th and May 3rd or whatever the date was of Derby, it was not. And Baedeker actually is quoted as saying there was, you know, there wasn't going to be any disposition between, you know, the time of the testing. And I mean, what could they have done differently? What's the learning out of this, and how, you know, how can things be made more transparent and you know, let the public feel better about the mechanics behind the scenes in this kind of thing?
Well, this I would tell you that the adjudication here was fairly typical of what happens in a drug case in racing. Now, in most of your cases, there is an explanation. There was an error in the barn, an error of management. The trainer can't explain it, but the drug is in the barn. Probably somebody did it accidentally. They may have given an overage of the medication. They may have been within the guidelines. There are any number of ways to do it. And you know, you rarely read about medication positives in the industry because those that we see are minor, and you're not seeing these major violations any longer. When you get into the contamination situations, potential contamination situations, or those that require an investigation, maybe an allegation of sabotage or whatever, they are carefully investigated, and they take time. We had a situation in the Mid-Atlantic a couple of years ago with a drug called glaucine. Falls into a similar category, actually is a little bit more serious than scopolamine, and it turns out that the glaucine is a derivative of something that's in poplar trees, and the company that was manufacturing the shavings for many of the racetracks in the Mid-Atlantic. The poplar trees had this glassing, and the horses were testing positive from the shavings. And this required an extensive investigation before the commission could conclude that there is no violation. The last thing a commission wants is to be accused of whitewashing or sweeping something under the rug, which is the implication here. And what happened here is, based upon all I'm reading, was there was an investigation, and they determined that it was not a violation. That's what you want commissions to do, particularly if you get independent commissioners who don't know anything about the sport. They're going to want to know from somebody, how do we explain this? Or do you just, you know, shoot first and ask questions later?
Yeah, I made that suggestion.
By the way, Steve, I believe that if we were in the federal system that is being advocated in the, under the Horse Racing Integrity Act, you'd have the same or similar process. You would be accused, you would have a hearing, could go to arbitration, and then you could go to the federal court system. And if I look at how the internationals do it, it takes much longer than we do it in this country. So, and there's not necessarily the transparency, because confidentiality would have to be important also. So, you know, you learn about doping violations in the Olympic world after they've been adjudicated. You know, people have had their hearings. You read about it in the equestrian world, the international equestrian world, after they've been adjudicated. It's to preserve reputations and to get it right.
Well, people are going to draw their own conclusions, and that's particularly frustrating when it comes to the general public that is really being fed regularly a certain narrative, and it gets tiresome, and it gets frustrating.
I suspect there will be more of this. I just can't believe this is going to be an isolated story, but we'll see. We'll see. It certainly was intended as a gut punch. It landed. It no doubt will be used as impetus to, I know it's interesting, the PETA, the Humane Society, and those who are most critical of our sport almost immediately came out with statements. They must have had an advance copy of the story. And you can see that this, you know, this is part of an effort to get to a place. It's a scorched earth. And, you know, it puts the industry in a very bad light, in a very bad position. And, you know, it just seems like everything that we do in this industry now is under attack. Everything.
Alan, I appreciate it as always. And everybody, you know, your vast experience, and particularly in this area, is an invaluable resource. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Steve. Anytime.
Alan Foreman, and we'll visit this issue as it evolves, but I, you know, will only reference back to the immediate aftermath of similar stories regarding the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, regarding Steve Asmussen, PETA, and I'll have another. It's always the same scenario. Always. Sensationalized for maximum effect, and then the slow pendulum swing back to details. To Matt Hegarty and Bill Finley's credit, they brought wider details and context within hours. So I'm sure there'll be more. Brian DiDonato is going to join us from the TDN. He was on hand and part of the absolutely crazy situation that saw the American Pharoah daughter out of Leslie's Lady fetch 8 $1.2 million yesterday, and an absolutely emotionally overcome Fred Mitchell, who has brilliantly managed the mare, her last foal at age 22. Well, she's 22 now. Amazing. Leslie's Lady. Brian DiDonato next.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years. We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and kept the summer on Afternoon Delights absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing, this is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
You have a heart, and we'll never be worlds apart. Maybe in magazines, but you still be my star. Baby, because in the dark, you can't see shiny cars. And that's when you need me there. With you, I'll always share. When the sun shines, we'll shine together. Told you I'll be here forever. Said I'll always be your friend. Took a note from a singing out to the end.
We're back at the races. A little past the bottom of the hour. Thanks to Alan Foreman for the visit. Happy to check in with Brian DiDonato, who was in the middle of all the action yesterday. And, of course, when I asked Sid Fernando yesterday, Sid, is it possible that the Leslie's Lady filly could top the Curlin from Tuesday? Sid said, maybe. Maybe. Well, Brian, how about doubling the sale topper from Tuesday? Good morning.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent. This was crazy. And it's just so funny when you hear the numbers and when you're watching the you know, the ticker go up and up and up, and you figure, well, it's Sheik Mo and Coolmore, and then when you were getting toward the end, you're thinking, the name Mandy Pope did flash in my mind, but I thought, no way, she's not, there's no way. And then minutes later, there it was, Mandy Pope. Talk about what happened.
It was funny because she was sitting right across from B. Wayne Hughes and the rest of the Spencer team, and they were up, maybe got up maybe to $4 million. So it was kind of, you could see them bidding back and forth, and then you knew somebody was in back, and usually that can only mean one or two groups. But it was crazy. I've never seen a yearling sell for that much in person, so it was definitely electric in the room.
It is amazing, my opportunity, and of course, you know, there's all kinds of stories about the Green Monkey moment at Calder, but I had been at Calder that day and then had to head to the studio when we, at the time, we were doing the 4 to 7 hours. And so I left, but John Parada stayed, and John called the show and called JJ and I and said, "You're not going to believe what just happened." And John was there in the 80s when there were, you know, the crazy numbers at the time. And even he said, but I think for a certain generation of people in the business to be on hand for it, it was just, they were just stunned. I mean, that seems to be everybody's reaction.
Yeah, I mean, you're more used to seeing it with mares. I mean, like the Phasic November sale, it's obviously, you know, half the horses sell for crazy amounts, and Mandy's usually in there getting those ones. But yeah, it was definitely pretty surreal.
From a couple of standpoints, afterward and in reading, you know, your account and you know, everybody that was on hand and mm-hmm. digesting three amazing days, was it more or less predictable that a filly with this pedigree would go as opposed to, you know, what would be a brother of Mendelssohn and Into Mischief?
I mean, I guess it's a little less predictable. I mean, generally the really high-end colts will sell for a little bit more, obviously, with their stallion potential. I mean, she's already kind of a ready-made broodmare. Obviously, it's going to be tough to recoup that unless she ends up being a good racehorse. But, I mean, there were rumors that this was the best foal out of the mare, too. So, I mean, I think people knew that she was a really nice horse. Even the mare's 23 years old or whatever she is. So,
yeah.
And you don't usually see that.
Well, and that, you know, you had quotes from and you know, the video of what is obviously an emotional Fred Mitchell. I mean, it, with all the wonderful things that Leslie's Lady has wrought for Clarkland Farm, I mean, this is some way to cap off a broodmare career.
Absolutely. And when they're keeping the next two foals, there's a Not This Time filly, and then she's back in foal to Cantheros, and I think she's carrying a filly. And they're going to keep those two. So this was the last one that's going to be offered at public auction.
Well, it put the cap not just on book one, but you know, on another just remarkable day. And I mean, you still have got books, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6 to go through after today's dark day. Summarize the first book, Brian. What were you most struck with?
Well, it's tough to compare the stats year over year because
right.
they've changed the format. So it was 4 days book one last year, three this year. But I mean, it seems strong by any measure. The first day seemed pretty solid, and then the second day got better, and then at the beginning of the third day, you know, I looked over. I was talking to my TDN colleagues, and one of us said, "Oh, it's going to be one of those days." You could just tell that. There are going to be a lot of million-dollar horses, and a lot of activity, and it's just from start to finish. And then even the last horse in the ring, you see Chad Brown come down with Peter Brandt. Coolmore was there. The L&J guys were there bidding on, I don't even know what the horse ended up going for, maybe 800. I think it was an Uncle Mo. But from start to finish, it was a crazy day like that. It was, you know, just a lot of money flying around.
Well, $750,000 for that colt that closed things out. And the Joneses, Aaron and Marie Jones, consigned through TaylorMade. And, you know, you mentioned Peter Brandt and Coolmore, you know, tied in that last one. And of course, you know, throughout the book one knockdowns, you had a lot of those, you know, those combinations, China Horse Club and Windstar, Maverick Racing. The now fairly frequent agglomeration of Vinnie Viola, Mike Rapoli, and Coolmore. Should this when this came about, Brian, there was real concern that it was bad for the market because these were entities that normally and historically, you know, would be competing against each other. What, you know, now that we've had a couple of years now of this becoming a regular part of the sales scene, what's the read now?
I mean, it certainly doesn't seem to be hurting prices too much. I think there are enough major players at the top where, you know, certain groups will team up, but for those, usually the top stallion prospects. But I mean, I think it's probably, it's allowed everybody to diversify a little bit and maybe even risk a little more than they would normally if they were just buying on their own. So, I mean, it seems like it's been good for the market from what I can tell.
A couple of notes about yesterday, and it you know, it's not too often. It's not too often in the session topper section of TDN, Brian, that the Phillies that they get to be on the front page, to lead it off. But they did yesterday because not only was there the Leslie's Lady sale topper, we're not getting anybody at $8.3 million. There was also a $2 million Empire Maker, this one. Bred and consigned by Gainesway. Sean Doonan buys that. A $1.1 million Medaglia d'Oro. This one, another Aaron Marie Jones product that New River Equine bought. And then, of course, on the male side, you had another five seven-figure sellers, including the Pioneer of the Nile, Powerhouse Sibling for Bob Edwards and E5 Racing, $2.1 million, tailor-made bred and consigned. There was the $1.3 million American Pharaoh, the $1.2 Curlin Colt out of Graz Emile that comes out of Glenwood, John Gunther, and was bought by West Bloodstock for the Lowe's. What else? Give us some of the other ones that you thought were maybe even bargains at big ticket prices.
Well, I thought one thing that was pretty interesting is the top seven horses were all by different sires. And,
nice.
A few years it was Tappet Warfront, and, you know, they were always at the top, but seven different sires. American Pharaoh, Curlin, Warfront, Tappet, Medaglia d'Oro, Pioneer of the Nile, and Empire Maker. Union Rags had a few nice ones, Quality Road, Into Mischief. Twirling Candy had one for $9.50. So it was, you know, a little more parity maybe at the top and not just, you know, the Tappet and Warfront show, which I thought was interesting. And we kind of saw that trend last year too.
Looking at the tally, the book one cumulatives, and obviously Sheikh Hamdan and Sheikh Mohammed with just a free spending 72 hours, 28 horses between them, 18 for Shadwell, 10 for Godolphin, and a total of $27 million spent.
Yeah, and I think Sheikh Mohammed bought the next maybe four toppers after the top one. He was very active. He was there, which, you know, it's always a little different when he's there. Godolphin seems to spend a little bit more money and kind of go for whatever he really likes, so it kind of changes the market a little bit when he's in town.
We've already mentioned Peter Brandt, and just by himself under the White Birch moniker, nine purchases for a little under $5 million. China Horse Club and Windstar, a little under $4 million for seven. Don Adam, who continues to really, play at the highest level. He bought seven out of book one for a little under $4 million. Larry Best, you can't go too far on these tally sheets without Larry Best showing up.
Yeah, and there are a lot of Into Mischief. He's kind of known for buying these really high priced Into Mischief. I think they're maybe somewhere in the 20s in book two, so I wouldn't be surprised to see him active in book two as well.
Tommytown Thoroughbreds with 7 purchases, $3 million. Ben Glass started to swing into action, and of course the sweet spot for Gary and Mary West and Ben Glass is always that you know, 250 to 450 range, and we can probably expect another dozen or so, maybe more, over really the next 5 days, I imagine.
Definitely, I'd expect him to be active in book two, looking for kind of typically book two is maybe a little more, they maybe don't have quite as much pedigree that, be considered more of the athlete types, and I think that's probably what, guys like that are looking for.
Well, the Albaugh family, of course, and Dennis's moment. I haven't even talked yet this morning about the draw for Saturday, the Pocahontas, the Iroquois, and a lot of excitement for Dennis's moment in the Iroquois. $2.6 million for 7. I mentioned Rapoli Viola Magner. The international set, the Japanese in particular, Mr. Hasegawa, right? And
yep.
There was also Yoshizawa as well. And they were active. But, really, China Horse Club 3, and then the ones in partnership, so 3, so make it 10 for them. Really, the international buyers, they made a splash day one, Brian, but then were a little quiet the next 2 days.
Yeah, I think the Japanese buyers were a little more active on day one. I think Sean Dugan's buying for an overseas group. I think they're from the Middle East. I'm not entirely sure, but, she was pretty active.
Well, 6 hips for $5 million, just a tag under. Let's talk about some of the stallion stories and obviously the big names, we note. You mentioned that one Twirling Candy, the only one in book one, 950. But what about, we had Run Happy and Frosted, Nyquist, the first crop sires. What were you struck with? What's the buzz on the first croppers?
I mean, Run Happy certainly did very well. He was third for weaning average, but now he's at the top for yearlings. They averaged 462,000. Obviously, it seems like the aggressive advertising campaign is working out. The few that I caught in the ring, there was one, I can't remember, I think it was one of the top ones. It was a very nice-looking, big, strong-looking horse. He's done very well. We'll see more of the freshmen as the books continue. But those seem to be the top three for now.
Well, looking ahead into the meat of the sale, when you get the kind of dollar numbers that were generated in book one, there's plenty of high-profile outfits, Brian, that undoubtedly were rebuffed these last 3 days, and so that pushes into book two and three.
Absolutely, and there's still a lot of firepower to go. I haven't really done a lot of work on book two yet. I took a look. The first horse through the ring is a Hardspun Half the Shackleford, and then there's still 7 Tappets, 3 Warfronts, 14 Curlins, 32 Into Mischiefs, a lot of Quality Road, Pioneer of the Nile. So
wow.
I mean, I think the prices will still be pretty high in book two.
Unbelievable. And, the other thing I'm always watching for is the pinhook interests.
Right.
And, they, in recent years, this goes back to a story that I can remember Glennie Kane Oakford first suggesting the scenario of pinhookers paying big, 6-figure numbers and then turning it into 7-figure sellers as 2-year-olds. But even the pinhookers that are willing to do that, and of course Hartley DeRenzo famously helped champion that, the late JJ Krupe, who's obviously going to be missed here at Keeneland and everywhere. But what pinhook activity? I mean, I saw a couple of little nibbles from some of the pinhook names.
I know there was one. Renee Daly had one. Maybe I think it was like a $500,000 yearling or weanling to $900,000. So a lot of those, people who were spending $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 on weanlings seemed to be rewarded with, close to 7-figure sales this time around, and that's definitely been a trend. Weanling to yearling pinhooks have been more popular. I think it's just because the market is so tough for the yearling prospects, especially if you're trying to pinhook, that people have kind of had to go back a year and find the weanlings and do it that way. And it seems to be paying off for a lot of people.
Well, and certainly, you know, certainly the familiar pinhook outfits, those names will start to, you know, fill in the gaps on the, you know, on the roster. And then when we get to about 125 to 50, when you start seeing a lot of those numbers, the Koreans will swing into action.
Yep. No yeah, they're doubt. Usually a little more active at the 2-year-old sales, but yeah.
Well, how about you? What about your group? How talk about what you're shopping for?
Well, we definitely haven't been shopping yet. I'll start looking more seriously, probably book three. Jason Barkley, my trainer, is going to, you know, he'll be in town. I think he'll start looking Saturday, and we'll, you know, start trying to find the value buys. We usually try to look for kind of win early types, obviously stuff that's more affordable. So we'll kind of be targeting the later books, but we'll see. No 8.2 million for us yet.
No, but you've gotten off to a wonderful start, and we should also, you know, talk just, you know, your own eye, Brian. Who are you interested in? I mean, when you and Jason start looking, is there a first crop, you know, sire that maybe you don't want to tip your hand that make everybody aware that you think is going to hit and maybe a value, you know, over the next week and a half?
I am interested in Frosty. You know, they'll obviously be a little pricey, but he kind of reminds me of Constitution. And we looked at every Constitution at the 2-year-old sales this year. We really liked him. We couldn't really find one that we liked and could afford, but he kind of reminds me. I feel like he has the same profile, just similar type of horse, really, really talented miler, same sire line. So, I mean, he's an obvious one, but Spitzer makes a lot of sense. I mean, Spitzer's emerging as a sire of sires. And he was obviously a very talented racehorse and has a huge pedigree. Outwork looks interesting. And I think Upstart's a little interesting, mostly because of just looking through the later books, the mares that he was bred to. I think he's going to have a lot of early types, which might catch some people by surprise.
Interesting. You know, and when it comes to stallions that are making, you know, an early splash, you mentioned Constitution. But Kozan got hot here over the last couple of weeks at just the right time.
Yeah, and I think he started off, I think he maybe had the most winners early on. I mean, he was obviously a very talented racehorse that didn't really get a chance to show it on the track. But he's been definitely tearing it up in Florida.
Journeyman stud, and there's always one of those Florida, you know, one of those Ocala specials, whether it's Ocala stud or journeyman, you know, whether it's a Cantheros. I mean, there's always, it's amazing actually how consistent there's been, you know, somebody bubbling under the surface, you know, getting backyard mares and just striking with them.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a long list of those, and I remember Adios Charlie had a few huge sales.
That's right.
Sales a few years ago. I mean, the Big Beast had a sale this year. I think was it 950. John Sadler has a filly. I think she was second in the Del Mar Debutante. So I mean, yeah, the Florida sires are always pretty interesting.
Well, Brian, I appreciate it, and we talked to Jessica on Tuesday, and you've got the team, you and Christine DeBernardis as well, and as always, the TDN coverage, just outstanding. 20 pages, because I printed out, it's 20 pages printed out daily, and the stories are wonderful, because you go, you know, it's been a lot of big names so far and well-known entities, but as we get into, you know, the middle portion of the sale, books 2, 3, and 4, there's going to be home runs for much smaller breeders, you know, people that have just a handful of mares, and, you know, they're going to be rewarded for the sale of a lifetime with one of their yearlings. And you guys always, you know, always find them and tell those stories. It's great.
I appreciate it, Steve. Yeah, it definitely gets a little more interesting sometimes to write, you know, to cover book 2 or book 3 where there's, it's not always the, you know, the top guys just duking it out on every horse, but yeah.
Well, be sure to follow Brian. Brian D. Donato, D-I-D-O-N-A-T-O. Well, that's an easy way to do it. D-I-D-O-N-A-T-O. That's the way to do this because it's right. There you go. B. D. Donato, TDN, and the Franklin Street Equine team as well that has gotten off to a really nice start. You can see more about what Brian and the team is doing. Franklin Ave Equine.com. Is that you're from Connecticut, right?
Yeah, it's South Franklin Park, Franklin
Avenue Giant Grinder.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. It's Little Italy in Hartford. So
you bet. modern pastry.
Yep. Oh yeah.
The Ravioli Kitchen, baby.
All those, yeah. I don't know how many are still open. I think modern.
They're all still open.
Franklin Giant's still open.
And, yeah. Although I'd say I've been going up the block when my father was in the hospital at Hartford Hospital. Mm-hmm. I found another grinder shop, and I shockingly preferred the meatball there. I mean, my count of Franklin Avenue Giant Grinder meatballs are it's. you need an abacus. you need Sperry Univac to count on many. I just made that connection. Yep. that Franklin Avenue, that you tied it in. Where'd you go to school?
Yeah. Connecticut College.
Nice. Too funny. What about high school?
I grew up, the town just south of Hartford.
Sure. Well, I went to Watkinson and they get tons of kids from Weathersfield.
Awesome.
Too funny. Too funny. I, how is it that I know you almost 20 years and this has never come up? It's pretty funny.
Yeah, I knew you were from that area too, but
from Manchester.
It was funny. Jason Bean posted the other day. I guess he was up in our neck of the woods and he went to Shady Glen. So I had to message him and ask how he liked that because that's always one of
Shady.
The places I remember most fondly growing up.
Shady Glen. It's about a mile from where I lived. Wow. Where I live, my father still is the home, the John and Bernice Rigg original, the cheeseburger. Even there, I tell you what, I've become a big cheese furter more and more when I go home.
Yeah, I actually never had that after.
Oh, the cheese furter is fabulous. Yeah. Fabulous. It's a Groton Weagle Frank. Just terrific. Well, there you go, folks. You just got you got a primer. We could go on without a doubt. Brian D. Donato, I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve. Talk to you soon.
We'll take a break. Top of the hour. And Rick Hammerly, it's the last day of Kentucky Downs action. Been a great four cards, and they got a little bit of rain, so hopefully that course is not as speed favoring as it was really over the weekend. Check in with Hammer, who's going to wrap up his Kentucky Downs experience, and he's going to head to Hot Springs next, back after this.